Welcome to the Feedback Show. Yeah.
Strange studies of strange stories.
Hola, my daughters, as they say on Gola. As you listen to this, we are meandering through the island of Dr. Moreau, but this is our chance to look back into the past in which we covered the future, and it was female.
There were so many great comments on these episodes, we couldn't possibly read them all.
Not out loud. We do read them all.
Oh, yes. Let's get started with study number 37, All Cats Are Gray. Author Meow writes, "The pacing is off on this one and the science is wrong, but there's something charming about Stina and Beth that I can't articulate. I just enjoy the story. Maybe because it's a space opera, I'm willing to forgive some errors if I get to enjoy the image of a big gray cat sitting on a spaceport bar drinking a glass of something weird."
Here's a comment that produced great shame in me. Alan Ricks writes, "You may have heard of the 1982 film The Beastmaster. It's loosely based on the Andre Norton 1959 novel The Beastmaster." Man, I can't believe we didn't mention that. In fact, I didn't know it.
I didn't know it either. I feel like a dummy. Beastmaster was one of those fundamental foundation fantasy films from my youth because it was on TV all the time. So I watched it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So thank you, Andre Norton.
Creator of Kodo and Podo, yeah. I assume. Also in the novel, they are thieves.
Shirok is my eyes. Andrew Brown writes, "Maybe the author liked the ending where the protagonist gets married. Sometimes we don't need to read too much into the reading." Mark K. writes, "Total agreement. She's a blue-collar spacer, finally gets one lucky break and retires. Rich."
Absolutely. I think it's lame when a criticism of a story is just, "Well, I thought it should have gone a different way that I wanted."
Yeah.
But I did feel compelled to comment on that one. Why does it make hay about her not making money or acting on her own tips that have made others rich right at the top?
Right.
So I can dig the story arc. You're saying that you're fine with it. Just surprised me based on how the character was set up. That's just to clarify.
Mark K. writes, "So I read that a little different than you did. Not A-team level stuff, though I would watch that series. I saw them as just her piping up at the bar, one honest scrapper who wouldn't hold out on her scrapper friends when she knows something. You don't want to mess with the Jovians while they're doing their moonrite, bub. And don't sell that claim, Keeney. You've got a real bit of unrefined slightite. You don't take payment for that sort of thing. So I saw the Empress of Mars was the first time she actually did the work and got a fair cut from it."
Alex Liggett writes, "I devoured Norton's Solar Queen series of novels growing up. I reread a couple recently, and despite a certain amount of he was feeling space sick, so he took some space aspirin and had a space nap, I really love the universe she builds. It's very much the universe of this story, full of space buccaneers and smoky space dives, amidst which are the crew of the free trader Solar Queen, plucky upstarts trying to make a go of it in a universe dominated by giant space corporations and whose success is down to their quick wits and superior skills. It's pure space competence porn."
Jim Cannon writes, "Quank Keep is even weirder than that summary suggests. All the characters have bracelets with dice in them, and when they concentrate on the dice, they can affect the outcome of a scene or battle." Chan, I had a stab at Quag Keep. It was on Kindle for pretty cheap, so I downloaded it and started giving it a read. It didn't really catch me, I gotta be honest.
No?
No, I gave it about maybe a chapter or two, and then I intended to go back to it, and that was like a month ago, so I don't think that's gonna happen.
That's odd, because I know that you wear a bracelet with dice in it.
I do.
So you'd think you'd be able to relate.
Yeah.
Didn't get you.
No.
Well, Jim Cannon likes it. You guys can argue about that later. Running Head writes, "As a red-green colorblind artist slash designer, a fact I've successfully hidden from many an employer over the years, the misrepresentation of the condition did irritate me a little. Norton's story also reminded me of a time in college when a friend of my girlfriend quizzed me about colorblindness. I told her all items that are red or green were completely invisible to me, which is why I could see the color of her bra through her red sweater. Her hands immediately leapt up to cover her chest, swiftly followed by a look of utter hostility for making her seem foolish." Yeah. "At the time, I immediately regretted the joke, but decades later, it still makes me chuckle." Yeah. Well, that doesn't sound like a regret to me. Jeremy Impson writes, "In the spirit of Jekyll-esque pedantry, I must remind you that the A-Team were soldiers of fortune, as stated in the title narration. That means we have to assume they were paid by everyone they helped."
Oh. One passionate advocate of cat-based space travel, CBST, writes, "This is true. I had to double check, but it even notes, maybe you can hire the A-Team. Maybe they're like a lawyer who does a lot of pro bono work and pay the bills with more conventional stuff. Like between episodes, the A-Team guards box factories or covertly captures great awks for rich folks' hats." Yeah, that would make sense. Because they don't seem to... It's been many years since I've watched the A-Team, but I don't remember them ever taking money from anybody.
Well, no, but it's the opening narration is to set up that they should be paid, that right. they're soldiers of fortune, and so that they look really generous when they don't take payment.
Right.
So if you don't have a setup that they should, then it's not a dramatic stretch for them to say, hey, forget about it.
Right.
And they're obviously broke because they wear the same thing every week. But I went to the back to the tapes. If you look closely, Mr. T is one necklace lighter in every episode.
Oh,
so
wow.
I think he's selling them off.
Yeah, that
makes sense. Like a dragon hoarding his gold with all those chains. But the people chasing them, they should just be hitting pawn shops. There'd be a pretty clear trail to where the A-Team is.
Makes sense. Eric, Speaker of Digressions writes, I first learned the phrase, in the dark, all cats are gray, from a Norwegian phrase book, where it didn't seem immediately useful. I note from an Andre Norton bibliography that there's a series of spacer novels about the crew of a ship called the Solar Queen, also published under the name Andrew North. The captain of the ship is named Captain Jellicoe. Memory Alpha doesn't mention if there's a connection to the Star Trek character. A few of the Solar Queen novels are available for free on Project Gutenberg, and one is called Voodoo Planet, a 1959 novel in which Jellicoe and his crew face African witch doctors in space, which I bet is not awkward at all.
No. So Captain Jellicoe, is that somebody in Star Trek?
Yes, that was a character who was captain of the Enterprise for a short amount of time when Picard wasn't around, and he was a bit of a hard nose that people didn't care much for.
When I hear Jellicoe, it makes me think of Cats.
Yeah.
And that terrible thing that happened where we thought it would be funny as a bonus to go watch Cats. And then also, like, around that time, Heather and I thought it would be fun, and it was, to go see Fantasy Island, the big screen adaptation.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And then the pandemic happened. Those were the last two movies I went to go see in a theater. You know, don't do that, guys. Like, B-movies aren't worth it that much. I couldn't believe it. I was like, are those going to be the last two movies I ever see?
Oh, no.
Thankfully, they're not. Carl Haikara writes, one thing I wanted to say is I'm happy that you guys kept up marches for Dracula's and all the Aikman month and those types of stories, even as you move into new waters, as I'm more into those things and less into sci-fi. But I love listening to you guys no matter what the story is, even a lame one like this, LOL. Thanks. One thing I thought about was if this story could be seen as a parody. As the narrator relates, he's a failed fiction writer, essentially, and the story ends up being a lame retelling of something he was told, with a pat ending the way he thinks pulp readers might like. Chad had mentioned that with the style of the story, it might even explain the ending as well, as the kind of plotting, which reminds me of a story I would have wrote as a kid.
Mm.
So, yeah, definitely the pulp writer could be putting the pat ending in there.
Yeah.
As cover, even, for the real Stina, who went on to do other things. In fact, Sean writes, as soon as I heard the description of Stina, I couldn't get Fiona Shaw's portrayal of Marva Andor out of my mind from the Andor series on Disney+.
Mm-hmm.
This colored my interpretation in two ways. The cat is a droid now, and the ending is obviously a cover story, so nobody comes looking for her.
Oh.
And yeah, I actually thought of that actress as well when they described Stina. She's great in that show.
Really good,
and
yeah.
I really enjoyed that show. We were complaining also on that episode that they just attacked the monster, the invisible monster, without knowing whether it was aggressive or not.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark K. wrote, I gotta say, regarding the creature's malevolence, you walk on a ghost ship where everyone died mysteriously long ago, where all the previous salvage crews die mysteriously, and then you see a mysterious ghost moving toward a crewmate. Some assumptions seem warranted.
You're right.
On another show, I feel like Chris would be making a stupid expert comment if they stood still to see if it wanted to give Cliff a big old hug.
Mark,
totally true.
When you're right, you're right. And you're
indeedy
right.
Duty.
And that gets us to study number 38, The Conquest of Gola. Crom Fuse writes, I was relieved to find out I'm not the only one who thought Dr. Zero was hot.
Nope.
You're not. Mm-mm. Gavin O'Brien writes, glad to hear my name called out as a supporter of the show. Been listening since 2012 and started supporting you all as soon as I heard you all asking for $6.66. I always look forward to hearing about whichever story that is covered for the week. Keep up the amazing work.
Thank you, Gavin.
Yeah. And It's a Ghost writes, fun fact, the actual mean surface temperature of Venus is 867 degrees Fahrenheit.
Whoa.
Yeah. It is the hottest planet in our solar system, even though Mercury is closer to the sun. It says here, from NASA.gov, the atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide, the same gas driving up the greenhouse effect on Venus and Earth, with clouds composed of sulfuric acid. And at the surface, the hot, high-pressure carbon dioxide behaves in a corrosive fashion.
It's the only thing hotter than Dr. Zero. You know, so I guess what you're saying is there can't be a race of rolling female blobs there.
Well, there.
I think the jury is still out on that one.
There could be. We've got some insane life forms on Earth, microbes and whatnot, that exist in the black hot vents at the bottom of our oceans. Mm-hmm. So maybe there is some kind of crazy life form that can exist in that environment that we're just would be very alien to us. But odds are not good if it's anything like Earth life.
Yeah. Eric, speaker in digressions, writes, I've taught a couple of iterations of Amazons in pop culture in courses, and the Ladyland tropes go all the way back to the ancient Athenians, and it usually involves an all-female society that goes around conquering their neighbors or otherwise being unpleasant until quote-unquote real men show up, seduce a few leading Amazons, and defeat the rest, possibly commemorating the occasion in public sculpture, like on the Parthenon.
Wow.
Glad to see that's not how this story goes. No, it's not.
Jason Thompson writes, maybe the word exploit didn't originally have such negative connotations. There's a whole thing called the explore or exploit question that my wife told me about. In early life, you want to explore new things, and as you get older, you tend to prefer to exploit things and activities that are familiar and successful for you. Probably some people are wanting to rename it.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. Yeah.
Sweating to the Great Oldies writes, I think this was more or less a reflection of mercantilism in action. The goal of every society is to take more and give less. Everything is zero sum. There is no such thing as cooperative gains. An approach common to most of the empires of Earth, and sad to say, coming back into favor with some folks right now. Jason of the K writes, these aliens remind me of the Dralocytes from the awesome TSR RPG Star Frontiers with their protoplasmic bodies, minus the golden fur, though. I remember good old Star Frontiers. That was a fun game back in the 80s. It was kind of the sci-fi version of D&D. They had their own setting. It wasn't based on anything else. It was fun.
Christine McCann writes, when I heard the description of great smooth cylinders glistening in the sky, I did not form the mental picture of giant toilet paper rolls for sure. Yeah, that's what I compared them to. Oh, they're like giant toilet paper rolls. And I missed that one too. Oh, they're in space. Into feedback number 10, sounding it out. So this was, we're talking about feedback on the feedback in which we were talking Dracula's.
Yes.
From March. Carcharodon Megs writes, the conflict / drama conversation remind me of one of my favorite old episodes, 134. You all did Algernon Blackwood's The Willows. Mm. The conflict on the differing opinions on that story was fire.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, we had some disagreements about that. Chris Barris writes, Chad's revelations in black is the king in yellow turned up to 11. The story contains a fictional play that nevertheless fascinates real people. Revelations in black is a fictional song that real people are somehow singing. Madness! I have to give props to Dan Pratt because when we announced our get-together coming up here soon, It's in the back room of the Cafe Coda here in Madison, and his comment was just reservations in back. It's very entertaining.
But that is true. That song is sort of King in Yellow-esque because I'm singing it all the time, and it doesn't exist, that song.
It doesn't exist.
Revelations in black, I'm gonna put on my slacks. Sort of. Eric Jordan Phillips writes, recently, I've fallen out of podcasts listening for nearly every other podcast except this one. And I think the difference between this show and the rest is that Chad is an accomplished songwriter and has been able to add that extra push to the overall production value on top of being our foil to our oftentimes straight man, Chris. Your music is great. I'm the straight man?
I don't know about that.
Is that what's been going on here the whole time? Eric goes on to say, all this to say, you both bring so much to the table and have introduced us to so many other, I'll bet, dead authors, and for now still alive musicians, that it really covers all my bases for podcast listening and most other entertainment purposes as well. Man, that is some high praise. Thank you so much, Eric.
Yeah, I can't believe you. I mean, accomplished is probably the... is meaning that I've written a lot of songs for sure. I have accomplished that work, but...
Chad, as musicians go, I know I'm your bud, but your music is some of my most favorite music ever.
Yeah, but then you bust out a lyric like, I'm going to put on my slacks, and I realize how much more work I have to do. I appreciate the praise, but stop showing me up, man.
Okay, sorry.
Drix writes, I'll throw my hat into the ring for what we should call us patrons. While I do like strangers, it reminds me of the Venture Brothers Guild strangers, I recall hearing you guys call us Stakers a few episodes back. That got me thinking of the most logical continuation of that name. We should be called Stokers. Think about it. Whenever a new episode comes out, I'm stoked. My fellow commenters are stoked to engage in discussion on these episodes. You guys are stoked to read them. I say we finish what good old Bram Stoker started way back in the day and bring stoking back in a big way. Stokers! Right on.
Mr. Zeal writes, not really enjoying the unresearched comments about British washing habits, fellas. A simple Google search about the history of bathrooms might have informed you. I still love you guys, though. XXZ.
As I wrote in the comments section, like, please let us know what it is about the history of bathrooms is that we're missing, because I did do a simple Google search and it wasn't immediately apparent to me.
Yeah.
But we were being kind of judgy about that. Yeah. To be honest, and Chris can tell you from our time as roommates, I actually don't shower all that often. You know, if I'm going to a job where I got to see people, I will. But
sure.
Since I work from home, it's way less frequent than it probably should be.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
You do what's right for you.
Exactly.
James Duffy writes, Chris mentioned cutting down buying books. Definitely rings true for me as well. I turned 40 this July and recently sat down and did a rough calculation of all the remaining film, TV, books, podcasts, video games, board games, and role-playing games that I have in my home to still consume, and realized I am most certainly dead before I get to it all.
Ugh.
Unless I quit my job, ditch my three children, and invent some life extension tech fast, hey, if that motivates you, man, do it, because I want to live longer too.
Yeah.
But I will say that it's the potential you're really buying. There's no shame on collecting. When you look at that range of stuff, you have a selection of things that you could spend your time on,
yes.
And that's the point, right?
Yeah.
So
you've got that power.
I'm a little more minimal, but not everybody is. You definitely, if that makes you happy, don't feel bad about it. No shame.
No. And I, in that same boat with you, I've got tons of stuff. I'm just now, as I'm getting older, and I see so many cool things that I have still to consume. I don't feel the need to buy as many things as I used to. That's all.
Yeah. And also, these kinds of things should never feel like a burden. I know sometimes people are talking about a TV show and I go, I got to find time to watch that too.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not entertainment anymore. It's just something you got to do to fit in. And that's lame.
It is lame.
It'll all be there. It's a Ghost writes, despite being someone who grew up in the 80s, it's this podcast that introduced me to both Manimal and Zomfear. And I can't thank you enough, I think.
And that gets us into Study 39, Space Episode. Sweating to the Great Oldies writes, I think the toxicity of gender roles is clearly the key to this story. The entire thing could have been written with no indication as to gender, just three humans plunging to their doom and wondering who will step up as hero, fool, and purchase the lives of their companions at the cost of their own. And that would have been a fine story about how we face fear, doom, death, compassion, humanity. But genders are indicated. The men are supposed to be fighting each other for the honor of stepping up because that's what it's meant to be a man. Their failure to snap into their gender roles fills them with shame and her with disgust. I suppose the reader's reaction just proves the author's thesis.
Jim Cannon follows up, yes, gender is the point. Without any direct explanation as such, the reader would assume them all to be men anyway. The point of the story is that a woman steps up and sacrifices herself to save others. No wonder people reading it in the 40s lost their
Yeah, I think it's interesting because the idea of men and women and their gender roles when the story was written was still, I mean, it was the 40s? I think it's the 40s. Mm-hmm. So women were only voting for, a little over 20 years at that point. So
yeah, I know. It's crazy.
There was no equality going on in that society. You know, this mm-hmm. was still a strongly male-dominated society. And obviously, it's science fiction, but it's representing this older 1950s, 1940s. Time period.
Yeah, you're interacting with that readership.
Exactly.
So
as a woman, part of the deal is that men are going to get to do everything and make all the decisions, but they're going to protect you. That's part of that idea in the 1940s. Like that, that's kind of laid out. That's what everybody's expected to do in American society, that the men will do the dangerous stuff and they get to make all the decisions, make more money, have control of things, but we'll protect the women. So then when we get to the time where the men are actually supposed to engage their part of that social bargain that exists, they don't. So they even fail at that. So I think that it's a lot more loaded than, I mean, obviously I don't think that there should be these assigned gender roles as a modern reader. But at the time, I think she's really saying something here that maybe about how there are these gender roles in their society, how these promises are made, but are rarely actually kept. It's not better or fair that the men do this and the women do this, and that's what it's really about. Or at least that's what I was getting out of the story.
Yep.
Jason of the K writes, as a discussion of gender, it is interesting, especially since we don't know what their jobs were. Was Lyda the mechanic of the ship? Eric was the only one who could pilot it, and Michael just a soldier with no real engineering skills? Thus, was Lyda the correct person to send? Or was she the least skilled in any area, but able to do a simple job, thus still the correct, i.e. most disposable person to send? The male-female dynamic really obfuscates the equality-equity debate here. Writers love the drama of no one stepping up to put their life on the line for others, even though wars are full of folks who did just that, and the news is full of stories of folks who try and often die in attempts to rescue others. It's a strange story trope for sure.
Yeah. We do learn that actually none of them have the appropriate skills.
Yes.
Because they are just adventurers who are overconfident in their abilities. So that played into it as well.
And humans can be really selfless. I mean, I remember there was this video of a dude going out into a raging river to rescue a dog.
Yeah, sure.
People do things like that all the time. So humans do have that capacity for risking their life to save somebody else.
Absolutely. Professor Koschka writes, not a fan of reality TV, but I want your pitch to be real. Talking about StarCapper.
Oh, yeah.
Was it real? You guys have such a good rapport and can play things so straight that it's really hard to tell. I'd just be shocked if you'd gotten a meeting with Michael Piller. I appreciated the Rachel Watch a Star Trek theme playing ever so faintly in the background while you discussed it.
Oh, it was very real. And that song, the Rachel Watch a Star Trek theme song, was written for that pitch, I believe, right, Chad?
Yep, threw that in to sweeten the deal on our package. And we saw and met Michael Piller, but he ran a company called Piller Segan at the time that was on Santa Monica and La Brea, which I saw in the news the other day because a helicopter landed on that intersection because there was some kind of shooting going on in the Target over there. You remember we used to go to that Target for lunch with Adam, who was the person we did meet with over there. But we were going there really regularly.
Yeah.
To talk about this over a couple of years. So yeah, it was real.
It was real. Sad it didn't bear fruit. Steve writes, not only do women not get a spacesuit, but cars, stairs, cutlery, and drugs are all designed for men. Even women's clothing. No pockets. That would spoil the line for the male gaze. On the story, he writes, not a bad story, but the physics are terrible. If the ship is accelerating towards Earth, at the start, the astronauts would feel it. And if they use the engines to avoid crashing, she would continue at the same velocity and crash into the planet. True.
Kate Sherrod writes, I haven't even finished listening to the episode yet as I write this, but I'm already calling it. This might be the best episode of either the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast or Strange Stories that you've ever done. A perfect pairing of a devastating story and insightful analysis.
Wow.
You make me proud to be part of this community.
Oh.
I'm glad. And then she finished the episode and went, God, can I take that back? How do you delete a comment? Kudos, too, to Kelly Maxwell for very sensitive readings. This anthology has proven to be an outstanding choice for a month's theme, or perhaps more than a month, another month sometime, perhaps.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'll say, you know, I always feel a little cringy about having a female month because it's kind of acting like, you know, half the population is a minority. I like to have a variety of male and female writers just in due course of the show. But in that case, it was such a good anthology. We thought a month was merited.
Yeah.
And actually, I realized later, Kelly's readings were a little slowed down. I've met Kelly a couple of times, but I don't know her voice well enough to realize that. She sent me the reading, and somehow when they were delivered, they had been slowed down on her side. So it was kind of funny because when I was playing the show, Heather goes, that's not Kelly. And I really panicked because I thought, oh, I just pulled somebody else's name out accidentally. This episode's out now. And I said, but no, we realized that that is what happened. Nevertheless, they sounded extra sultry. So,
oh, whoa. So that's not what she sounds like.
No, she sounds like this. No, I'm just, they're just a little slowed down so that they don't sound weird, but it's a little deeper than her voice actually is. Yeah, we'll have her back on the show so you can hear her real human voice.
Wow.
But it worked.
I didn't notice. Jim Cannon writes, I like that Lyda is allowed to be resentful. If this were three dudes, it would be full of, it's a far better place I go nonsense, or at least, I'm going out, I may be some time, terseness. But Lyda gets to be human even while being a stone-cold badass.
That's one thing I can really, aside from all the gender stuff, I really loved that she was making the sacrifice and it was making her mad.
Yeah.
Because I get really sick of that trope where people are like, I'll buy you some time. You know, my ankle's twisted anyway. You guys escape. Whatever. I'm so sick of that. And, you know, on that topic of male and female roles, there is some expendability sexism when it comes to men, because you were saying earlier, the deal is you got to make a bunch of decisions, but then you have to protect, etc.
Uh-huh.
But for most men, they don't get to make any decisions.
No.
That's if you're a man with resources.
Sure.
We'll talk about it on the bonus episode this month. But when I was watching the 1932 Lost Souls the other day, that was on full display because the main character says to Moreau, you know, I could handle it when I thought you were doing this to just men, but doing this to a woman is inhuman. So we're talking about surgically, he thinks that he has been destroying the lives of, I mean, a ton of men on that island, but one woman. And it was like, we can't do that. What do you mean? Why are these men? Because they're men, they could be soldiers and you can throw as grist into the mill, no problem, because they're men.
Oh, yeah.
And usually they're the lowest on the totem pole, too. We're talking about men. They're not making any decisions.
No.
They don't have any power.
No, you're right.
But you go, you know what? Because you are a male, like, big deal that you die.
Yeah.
That's effed up, too.
It is. It's all effed up.
Yeah.
Jim Cannon writes, still thinking about this one. I find it interesting that these pulp heroes, when faced with the possibility of death, are galvanized into action. But when they encounter the inevitability of death, they freeze up. The two boys really are Captain Kirk's. They don't believe in a no-win situation, which makes Lyta, the Mr. Spock, doing what needs to be done.
Into Study 40, The Miracle of the Lily, Matthew Alderman writes, sorry to be that guy, but life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which I, of course, think is a very good thing, is in the Declaration of Independence, not the U.S. Constitution. Which is what I said.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I know that, but you're blabbing.
Yeah.
And you just say dumb things, which I did a couple of times on that episode. I mixed up the Declaration and the Constitution, and I also implied that spiders are insects in that episode. So I found a spider that teaches history. I apologized. I think we're cool.
Jim Cannon writes, well, this is a fairly preposterous premise with a barely adequate understanding of biology or how evolution works, but as an allegory for how human beings are systematically destroying the environment that we depend on for our existence, I say it knocks it out of the park. The insects of Venus, as opposed to the furry Amazons of Venus, were a nice Twilight Zone-y twist. I don't know about stagnation or the perils of life without conflict, but Earth as a barren rock paved over with Megacity 1 is nightmarish to the extreme. Humanity survives, but, like you discuss, to what end, ultimately? Sounds like a supremely horrid existence. Except for the electric skates, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah.
Electric skates would make everything worth it.
Totally.
Thomas Painter writes, this story reminded me of another story in which insects threaten humanity, Doomsday Deferred, by Murray Leinster, writing as Will F. Jenkins. I read it as a kid in Alfred Hitchcock's Monster Museum. I ran across the book in a used bookstore a few years ago, picked it up for old time's sake, and was reading Doomsday Deferred in a pizza joint when out of nowhere, I found myself becoming actually scared by the story.
Oh, wow.
Goosebumps and all. And that doesn't happen to an old horror hand like me. If you want some horror with your sci-fi, it wouldn't be a bad choice for the show. We'll have to check that out. As with all your recommendations, we put them in a document, and we revisit that when we're looking for new material. So thank you. Always recommend stuff. We appreciate it. And I hope that was the story that was giving you goosebumps and that there wasn't something wrong with the pizza you're eating. Also, something to check out, David Halstead writes, there is a metal cover of the song in the year 2525 by Fields of the Nephilim.
Fields of the Nephilim.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't believe I didn't know about that because I love that band.
Yeah.
Love them. Even in the later metal incarnations, I love the Nephilim.
Yeah.
So I did go check it out and I liked it. Extra credit, episode number 10, we talked about The Lure, we talked about Atlantics, and we talked about Bathtubs Over Broadway. All pretty cool films.
Yes. Nils Hedgeland writes, with regards to Polish mythology, there's a Netflix series called Krakow Monsters. It's another Monster of the Week series, kind of an adult Buffy. But because it's based in Poland, the monsters are all very different, and I assume based on Polish mythology. With regards to industrial musicals, episode 4 of Amazon Prime's Marvelous Ms. Maisel has a full industrial musical as part of the story. Oh, wow. I've heard that's a good show. I've never seen it.
Well, everybody likes it, including Heather. I hate it. I can't hear it. Like, it's, I don't know what it is, but I said to her, I was like, this is like the Gilmore Girls for me. I like can't be in the same room as it. There's something bombastic about the way they edit the dialogue, or there's just an aggressiveness to it that really annoys me. People love the show. I like all the actors in it. I can't watch it. But it's funny because then she goes, yeah, it was created by the same person as the Gilmore Girls. So I'm thinking there's just something about that style that doesn't click with
me.
Even though I know people love both of those shows. Like, I literally have to leave the room if it's on. Wow. It drives me nuts.
That's your kryptonite.
It's my kryptonite, yeah. That and Billy Joel. Fred Bednarski writes, oh, hey, I'm a Polish guy listening to the podcast, and I'm here to help. In terms of pronunciation, Chad is doing quite well.
Yay.
The name of the director would be pronounced akin to Agnieszka Smoczynska. And Chad was pretty close. As for the movie, I've seen it years ago, so my memory is hazy, but it's quite an outlier compared to contemporary Polish cinema, and it's supposed to feel quite otherworldly. Saying that, there are quite a few recent Polish films and TV shows that use, especially late communist Poland, as a setting, so it's not completely disconnected to what's happening in Polish media. For what it's worth, when I watched it back in the day, I did feel it carried a feminist message that blindly following traditional patriarchal values leads to losing yourself. But again, this is just a hazy memory from a dude that is not a film critic nor a feminist scholar. The articles you quoted do a much better job at exploring the themes than I ever could, but hey, if you ever need someone to help pronounce and place in context some Polish stuff, hit me up. I'll certainly do that, Fred. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Gordon writes, in my opinion, I think all the mermaid mythology comes down to guys being stuck with guys on a boat for a long time without women.
Mm-hmm.
Probably younger dudes at sea. Just going to say that in the last days of basic training, the lunch lady was looking pretty good.
Yeah.
Alan Ricks writes, Most people would probably recommend The Lighthouse or The Shape of Water if you're interested in relationship between humans and sea ladies or fish gents. But I think the 2017 Spanish-French film Cold Skin should get some exposure. I see what you did there.
Did you see Cold Skin?
I did, yeah. It's got that dude from Rome, you know, is the... was the Punisher. What's his name?
Oh, that dude from Rome.
you know what I'm talking about?
I do know who you're talking about. He's also in one of my favorite films from this last year, RRR, on Netflix, which is totally insane.
Yeah.
What a great movie. Phil Jensen writes, personally, I like crossing the decade lines. You'll be in your early 50s versus your late 40s. Happiest of days, Chris. Yes. Chris, this is now that we're recording, this is your first show as a 50-year-old.
Oh, God, yeah, it is.
Are recording.
I'm now 50.
How's it feeling?
It feels pretty much the same, not too different. But, you know, we'll see here. Things are slowly falling apart. We'll see how long that lasts.
I also want to say happy birthday to Rachel Lackey.
Yeah.
It's coming up this week. And also to my wife, Heather Klinke, who is having her birthday on the weekend. It's a big birthday month in May.
It is. So many Tauri.
So many Tauri, that's right.
Well, with that, I think the best way to end the show is, whoa.
No.
For the longest time. Get out of here,
Stop.
Chad. Whoa.
It hurts.
Sing us a song. You're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.